Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Well, hello out there in internet land. This is John Stanko, your host for another day, another week of Wake Up to Purpose. I don't know what kind of weekend you have, but if it's like many of my friends, and it was a weekend to remember, that's for sure. I think the image of the violence in Minneapolis, the police officer, and Mr. Floyd, and then the events immediately following will be in our minds for a long time to come, and right up there with 9/11, or if you're old enough like me to remember the Kennedy assassination, or any of the other watershed moments in history, very sad, very disturbing, very alarming, very, moving is, it sounds too positive, very traumatic, and fill in the blank from there. And so today I've asked my friend and colleague, Pastor Sheldon Williams, a former police officer who is now a pastor, but still very involved in law enforcement. We go to ball games. He's greeting half the force who are there on duty, so he still has many relationships, and I know he has served on a review board. So I've asked him to come on, and he's waiting in the wings to talk to us. I watched him. I watched his wife over the weekend. They were on several broadcasts, one from our church, really both were from our church, and one was Facebook Live, one was a video of a discussion facilitated by our co-lead pastors with three good friends, African Americans, two pastors, Sharon White, who has been a guest on this show. If you didn't see that, I shared it on my Facebook page. Please go there. It's worth an hour of your time, and to hear their perspective as human beings, as Christians, as men and women, African Americans, and so how appropriate for Sheldon to be on the show today. He is waiting in the wings, and we will get there in just a moment. And so I've not had this many shares on Facebook of a link that for a show that I have had. It's been a while, and so I prayed more about this one than I do most, because I just want to get out of the way and allow whatever God wants to happen and whatever Pastor Sheldon would like to say to be said without any kind of interference from me. Even though it was a painful weekend, a traumatic weekend for many people, churches began to open up yesterday, and so I know that's an encouragement to many people and many leaders to be back in the saddle, so to speak, although I personally think the church did quite well. When I'm talking church, the body of Christ, throughout the lockdown times, and some still have not emerged, but use social media as effectively as they could. I'm appealing for them to continue to use it, not to be an afterthought or as an addendum to ministry, but as a major investment in ministry. As I think we were touching many more people than those who may come within our doors. And I guess that was one of my thoughts in watching the interview with Sheldon and Ross Owens and Sharon the other day, is that that's such an important conversation, but unless you're part of our church, you may not be able to hear that or hear it on a regular basis. And so that's why we, in my estimation, need to be putting things out there as regularly and as often as possible with good quality, with good content. And so churches have begun to open up, and this Friday our area goes green. That means businesses can open up, and one of the first things I'm going to do next week is get a haircut. And so a lot of interesting days ahead. I think there's going to be a lot of economic shakeout from this, but again, that's not why you've tuned in. Let me read you Psalm 94. I start every show with a psalm. For many weeks, we were reading Psalm 91 to reaffirm our trust and faith in God during the pandemic and the economic crisis. We still stand on those promises and that reassurance. But I want to read Psalm 94. I read this last week. I read it this morning on my Facebook Live broadcast, and I want to read it again today. The Psalms, well, you know, when you don't have words to describe what's going on, you go to the Book of Psalms, and it is generally eloquent and accurate in describing the human dilemma. So let's read Psalm 94, the NIV version. The Lord is a God who avenges. O God who avenges, shine forth. Rise up, judge of the earth. Pay back to the proud what they deserve. How long, Lord, will the wicked? How long will the wicked be jubilant? They pour out arrogant words. All the evildoers are full of boasting. They crush your people, Lord. They oppress your inheritance. They slay the widow and the foreigner. They murder the fatherless. They say, the Lord does not see. The God of Jacob takes no notice. Take notice, you senseless ones among the people, you fools. When will you become wise? Does he who fashioned the ear not hear? Does he who formed the eye not see? Does he who disciplines nations not punish? Does he who teaches mankind lack knowledge? The Lord knows all human plans. He knows that they are futile. Blessed is the one you discipline, Lord, the one you teach from your law. You grant them relief from days of trouble, till a pit is dug for the wicked. For the Lord will not reject his people. He will never forsake his inheritance. Judgment will again be founded on righteousness, and all the upright in heart will follow it. Who will rise up for me against the wicked? Who will take a stand for me against evildoers? Unless the Lord had given me help, I would soon have dwelt in the silence of death. When I said, my foot is slipping, your unfailing love, Lord, supported me. When anxiety was great within me, your consolation brought me joy. Can a corrupt throne be allied with you, a throne that brings on misery by its decrees? The wicked band together against the righteous and condemn the innocent to death. But the Lord has become my fortress, and my God, the rock in whom I take refuge. He will repay them for their sins and destroy them for their wickedness. The Lord our God will destroy them. As I said, when you need words to describe what you may be thinking or feeling, and you don't know what to say or how to frame it, you can go to the Book of Psalms. So let's go ahead without further ado and bring on my guest today, Pastor Sheldon Williams. Pastor Sheldon, welcome to Wake Up to Purpose.
Dr. John, it's always good to be with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We didn't have a chance to do a voice check, so if you're on a speakerphone, you may want to disconnect because it'll tend to come forward a little better if you can. But at any rate, I am so sorry to I wish I'd have you on to talk about what we think the Steelers season is going to be or how the restaurant is going, and I do want to get an update on that, but we've got some very serious issues to discuss, and of course, you wear so many hats. I encourage our listeners, if you haven't looked at Sheldon's pedigree for talking today, it's on the page that announces our show. But Pastor Sheldon, just talk about for a minute what it's been like for you as a man, as an African-American man over these last 4 or 5 days to see what you saw in Minneapolis. Just how are you processing that?
Yeah, thanks, Dr. John. And
you know, like many, I'm sure many of the listeners now, and we see what's happening across our country. Actually, you can see it across the globe. You see reactions from all over. I was astonished to hear that there were protests happening in the UK and I forget what other country. There was like, I was shocked to hear. I mean, they're protesting the events of George Floyd. But, I mean, it has such impact. What people saw with George Floyd just really shocked. But it wasn't no new shock for some of us. And I'll make some distinguishing comments not to alienate any particular group or to try to, you know, just categorize a certain group of people as being more impacted. That's not what I mean at all. I have one. I have a viewpoint that's a particular viewpoint because it's one that I live. It's one that I experience. It's the one that I've had to have discussions about what we're talking about today, and it's from the African-American viewpoint, and especially as an African-American black male. So George Floyd was a very strong inflection point for a lot of people, and I'm glad that there's a move to action. But I've the last 4 or 5 days, as you have described in processing, is still trying to get a good grasp of how to process it. I'm stirred in a way that I've never been before, even though I've actively participated throughout my life towards pursuit of equality and justice and fairness. And felt it particularly important to do so in matters and places where God had placed me, in the military and certainly in law enforcement. I'll describe some of that. And I hope your listeners don't hear this as pats on the back, just laboring where God had me serving. And I do it even now as a servant, as a pastor, and on the pastoral staff at our church. I'm still laboring as a servant and continue to find those connections within community and those established groups so that I can keep on bringing forth change or impacting when we need to make change. So the matter at hand, my strong, very visceral reaction comes about not just because of George Floyd, and I've described it like this. It was a culmination of several incidents all at one time, and it set something different. It presented something different to me, as if, you know, opened up, like, where are we in America right now? And I'll describe them like this, and you've heard me in other settings because I said the same. Breonna Taylor, African-American female, who was an EMT sitting at home with her boyfriend, and a execution of a search warrant, and the type of search warrant that was executed, which was permissible in that area, what's called a no-knock search warrant, which means they don't knock and announce and they go right in. But they, when they made the entry into the home, the two inhabitants felt that this was somebody breaking in, and she ended up being shot 9 times, I believe, and she was shot and killed. That incident. Then we had Ahmaud Arbery, a jogger, in a T-shirt and shorts, running down the street, and a group of vigilantes go out to, what they say, detain him, although we can see intent and motive just from arming themselves and going out, reminiscent of the 40s and 50s before we even get to the civil rights, but even through then, to jump into your pickup truck armed with your weapons to go stop the bad guy. And he ends up losing his life. The Cooper incident, when you had Mr. Cooper and then Mrs. Cooper, and I always say the irony between that, both named Cooper, in the park. Here there's an exchange between them, and she then wants to leverage the 911 system to her benefit and then classifies him as a threat and falsely states to the 911 dispatcher and makes up a scenario as if to get the police officers there under false pretense and probably trying to press and escalate a situation that probably would not have been very beneficial to Mr. Cooper. And then we get to George Floyd, and we witnessed not an incident, not seconds of improper conduct on behalf of a police officer, but for 9 minutes, we watched this man's life be taken from him. No regard for his cries out or the citizens that are all around. Didn't hear responsive to him saying that he can't breathe, wasn't responsive to him in anguish in agony, even as much as you're starting to see him physically start to succumb to the positioning. He had small trickles of blood coming out. They couldn't even observe him not start losing his consciousness and stop breathing. And then a very callous disregard for him, even after he laid lifeless on the ground there, is highly disturbing. And disturbing because it seemed like they just didn't care. In broad daylight, didn't matter if cameras rolling, didn't matter whether people were around, they felt like they were in the right to do these things. So what's happening in America that allows individuals to be so brazen, so bold, to feel like I'm well within my right? And we keep seeing these incidents play out when there is an infringement on some other people's rights. And some of those rights that were supposed to be all encapsulated within our Declaration of Independence. And all I'm seeing are individuals that look like me who are not permitted to have the same level of independence and the rights that we say we're all supposed to have in the aspect of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So, I mean, these things just are challenging me in such a deep way. But it's bringing forward. There are so many other incidents that have happened, but we can pick apart particular use of force as part of police officers, and we can pick those apart, and you and I have had discussions in the past and how we articulate that. And there's sometimes I can defend some of the actions, whether the citizens may not approve of how that came about. I can just see where that's justified, just applying tactics in law. But there is not zero. There's zero articulation of justification or reasonableness when it came to George Floyd. And I stood out very quickly and said, I challenge any subject matter expert. I'm willing to do it. We could pick it apart and see where they would find some justification for his actions and applying all police tactics, and I'd be willing to debate that issue. But as it seems right now, I have not come across a subject matter expert that has had an alternative description of what happened, because this one kind of stands out to be so wrong. So, you know, that one, it really stood out, and I think it probably has touched a little soft spot for me as well, the Antoine Rose incident. For the life of me, and I understand we don't like rehashing court cases, but the police officer was acquitted in the deadly shooting of Antoine Rose, and it disturbs me how they could render that decision when you saw the young man, two young men actually, running away from the police officer, which commonly happens. You know how many criminals ran away from me whenever we rolled up onto a scene? And his articulation of threat, and with three shots, he was able to put Antoine Rose down and shot to kill him as he was running away from that police officer. That was already outstanding, and then we move forward to this. So a lot of background, but it is stirring something, and I really ask God to allow it to stay a burden in my heart. I hope he continues to allow it to provoke my spirit, because I don't want another opportunity to just let this one pass and we have not done anything to pursue change or to redirect policies or opportunities so that these incidents don't happen. I got to contribute in a more significant way, even more than where I am now, and make some opportunity, because who's the next insert your name? But it's going to be somebody who looks like the George Floyd again. And something's going to come up, and that person could possibly lose their life.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Sheldon Williams, a former police officer, now a pastor, but still very much in touch and involved in our community. And we're just obviously talking about the tragic events that have gone on over the last 4 or 5 days. Sheldon, I'm not privy to all the training and what will go on with a police officer. Is there ongoing, I don't know what else to call it, ethical training or scenario planning or confrontation, you know, of what the things that they may be encountering? Is there something we can do to train, and even I would have to believe people who may be a little racially triggered easily could be identified and reassigned or but talk to me about the training. Is there something practical mm-hmm. within the training that is lacking that in your estimation could be done?
Sure. And I always like to lay out that we should not expect out of our police officers what we're not willing to pursue within society. We can't expect our police officers to operate with a certain ethical manner as it relates to race relations and treatment of people who look differently when we're not pursuing that as a society. Because all you're going to get individuals who are same society who are now occupying those positions. And so I will say, I mean, there are times where individuals are able to suppress some of their inner feelings. I've seen both sides of it. I've seen individuals who were rogue, and you can tell they had very deep racist types of behaviors, and departments really try to weed those individuals out and they'll act on them. But, you know, I've also seen what some people don't understand, the biases that they hold and some of their actions and stuff. Because of those biases, you see some of their actions and are towards certain individuals is because of those biases. But police departments across the board and public safety across the board, they really try to expose people. And there's, you know, when it talks about ethical behavior, you cannot teach ethics. It's impossible to teach ethics. You have to present ethical behavior. It's up to somebody to embrace that and make it part of their ethical fiber. So it's not like you're going to teach a class and somebody's going to go, ding, ding, because I got this education, I now hold on to ethical behavior. It's not. So there's only two ways. You present ethics, but also you can administrate it. And when people don't follow the ethical code, and then you're able to administrate it. And that's where punitive decisions come down, whether it's reassignments and whether it's discipline that's given to the individual, it's all the way up and including firing. When they don't adopt those ethical behaviors. And then there's the problem where we have the very strong aspect of the FOP, Fraternal Order of Police, for which I am a current member. And it's one of the issues, and that you see this with a lot of labor unions, that individuals want to protect the individual, and I think that they're obligated to a degree. Because if you have a member as part of a union, you have to be able to ensure that person's interests are cared for. But instead of them just covering what's right, it's always on behalf of the individual trying to get them protection of them. And sometimes, you know, there are decisions that are made, and that very strong FOP, even when police supervision or the city or govern them do certain decisions, they're overturned. Because you get into some of the legal aspect of it, and,
sure.
and then some attorneys then say, oh, no, you know, these boards were too heavy-handed, whatever. So the point is, you can keep presenting that. But my issue with the whole training aspect, they are about treatment of people and being aware of the sensitivities. And some individuals really push back on those topics. You know, they feel like, why are you teaching us? You know, they make fun and like it's a mockery. I've seen it in classes that I've taken, and you know, when we were required to go to ethics training, and they're getting better because they're presenting scenarios and stuff like that, so they could be more eye opening for people instead of just pushing on information. But there are still individuals who feel like it's a big waste of time. But we can't deter from continuing that level of training because it's necessary. But from the time a police officer goes into the academy, from the time they go into training, all aspects of police training is guiding them through the potential threat. They don't identify the threat like if you see black males. And, you know, they're not describing it like that, but they're talking about these moments that could change in a millisecond, and we got to be prepped and ready and keep observant. You've been with me plenty of times, and you know that, you know, how I operate when I'm out and about. I mean, that's part of the training. It's part of the experience. And I'm not faulting that, because absolutely, there have been many situations I've personally been in where, wow, thank God it came out the way it did, because that could have been been detrimental to me. I could have lost my life. But my point that I'm raising is, when you're that focused, and that's what that training is throughout all the academy, is that keep your head on the swivel, 360-degree coverage, ensure that you're watching to make sure that the person is not a threat, that you approach that threat to minimize that threat, and, you know, all those things that are absolutely correct in teaching. But when somebody has a preconceived in the background, in the subconscious, if it might be in their forward mind, they're making conscious effort, and because they hold on to those biases or whatever, or maybe it's the implicit or subconscious bias they might have. But if you already have determined that somebody is a potential threat to you based on the color of their skin, well, when you make your approach to that individual, you're already starting down a decision-making pathway and may not even be realizing it, and have determined this person to be a threat, and this person could be walking down the street with a cell phone. This person could be an individual who's running around the corner because they're jogging, but now you got a description of somebody and with a clothing description, but you now pick up this person that's running, and if you already started, this person is a threat. Well, that's part of the problem, and that's where some of the increased awareness, so that people can start working against those implicit and subconscious biases that may be existing, but we see that playing out. The ramifications of police encounters are a lot more severe. In a millisecond, an individual can lose their liberty and their life and or their life. But we see these things playing out in regular person-to-person exchanges. Going to the gas station, you can see the person behind the counter who looks different than the other person at the counter, and you see some of their biases coming out, or in the store, and, you know, because it's a societal issue. That's where I'm trying to point at.
Yeah, and it's I appreciate you framing it like that, but I want to go back to the key issue. There is training. There is an ongoing training to help officers frame and understand the situations that they encounter.
Yeah, and describe me like, yeah, there's absolutely, there's a set training. It's part of academy training when individuals first come on, and that's setting that ethical code that this is how we're supposed to operate in interactions with people who look different than you. And there is ethical training there, and then there are updates that all officers have to go back and take, and you know, and they focus on those so that it's just presenting information. And that's what I said. It's all you're doing is really presenting information, because if the person does not adopt that in their ethical code, then all it was information for that moment in time. Then that's when you move over to administrating, because then if a person doesn't follow and you start seeing that they're having certain incidents that look like that are violations, well, this person is not embracing the ethical code. And I think that's where you get that when they don't, and you can start red flagging, you got multiple complaints and this, that, and the other. And I want to encourage listeners that some people really, they're disheartened. And we hear it. We even heard it with Officer Chauvin, the one that was the officer, Chauvin, that was the one that was on that held down George Floyd. You hear that there were multiple complaints and uses of force. I don't want listeners to be disappointed that they and to think that these things don't have effect. They do, and I don't want them to be disheartened. But I want them to continue to make those complaints when things happen, because that's the only way that we're going to be able to address those issues. If the person never has a complaint against them, then they're never going to ever be on the radar to be watched, and so you have to continue to complain about those. But again, those red flagging, and some departments are aggressive, towards addressing that. We went through in Pittsburgh, we went through a period of time with the consent decree that I worked under, and saw the relief of that consent decree before I retired. But we were under a federal mandate to make changes. And we must understand we were the first police department in the country to ever face a consent decree, a federal consent decree. There were lawsuits brought forward for excessive force. And instead of those lawsuits going up and continuing, the federal government that says if you make and institute these changes, then there's a reduction of the penalty your department could experience. Well, we saw that. I mean, I remember when Geraldo Rivera was here, he did a show. It was called Blacks in Blue. He did this whole show back in the early 90s where he came here and was talking about African Americans and police officers. He detailed some of these things, and then we were in the consent decree. So the point I'm raising with that is policies and procedures, because the government, federal government, was overseeing our efforts, and following that, there were other departments that have been subject to consent decree. Now, why that's beneficial is because I got to tell people, because it really does tie in. It didn't happen. Pittsburgh was put under the consent decree, Dr. John. But in 1995, Johnny Gamage over in Brentwood, it was Brentwood Police that had stopped Johnny Gamage in his Jaguar, I believe it was. And Johnny Gamage was the cousin of Ray Seals, the Pittsburgh Steeler. And some of your listeners will remember. And he was stopped, and this is where something called positional asphyxiation came about. And he was killed. He ended up dying in the custody of Hold Him Down. And as he struggled to breathe, and he fighting them, and they just exerted more power on him, more force on him, and he ended up dying. You know, that changed police tactics. It impacted training because of the result of that across the country. And we were fully aware of what we call positional asphyxiation, watching our handcuffing, how we hold suspects down on the ground. That changed back then, and that was a result of Johnny Gamage, which happened right here in the suburb of Pittsburgh. That changed training all across the board. I want to backdate a little bit. The Rodney King incident that happened in California that we all witnessed, this man with the use of force, those California police officers, and their theory for controlling, they had what was called a total control theory. In Pittsburgh, we operate on the plus one theory. Plus one theory of force is you're able to go one level of force higher than what's presented to you, but it's not just a stair step. If somebody has their fist, that's when somebody would pull out a baton. If somebody would have a stick, that's when they would go up to the weapon. But it's not absolute like that, because then you also have to articulate deadly force encounters, that if it's likely that your life could be in jeopardy or somebody else, you can take a stick. And if that person was about to take someone else's life, then deadly force is authorized. That's plus one. Mm-hmm. But total control says stop moving or I'll use force. So that's what you saw with Rodney King. Every time he moved, even though you're being hit, I've been hit with nightsticks, but we were in big padded, you know, suits that would protect us. And I could still feel the inertia from that weapon being swung. I could still feel it. It didn't hurt me. But this man's bare skin, and you saw what happened on that video. Mm-hmm. What I'm making a point with that is they were under what was called total control theory. So if you said lay down on the ground and he raised his hand, they were permitted to use force. Now, the citizens might say that's unreasonable. And it was determined to be unreasonable, but they were operating under a theory. Now, what ended up happening is the local courts exonerated those police officers, but the federal government came in and said, no, it's a violation of Fourth Amendment. Mm-hmm. And then they saw those Fourth and 14th, actually. And then they end up going to prison. But my point is they had to change the way they operated in policing. So I go back to Johnny Gamage because it relates to George Floyd. Johnny Gamage was 1995. Our tactics began to change. And I might be wrong on that date, so don't hold me exactly to that. But it was in the mid-90s or so. And we changed our tactics. It's 2020. There's no way that a police officer could have felt comfortable. I know we witnessed. He was very comfortable, and that's what I'm saying. Something's broke because there's no training that we give. I've taught use of force. I was a use of force instructor. I'm subject matter expert on use of force. When we come in and to hold somebody in that position, nowhere have I ever seen where you were permitted to hold your knee on the neck of a suspect. There is a technique that we use in speed cuffing, coming in to put somebody that you can come in when, and grab. If somebody's prone out, meaning laying on their stomach, you could grab their arm, and I'm trying to describe this so people can see and visualize. You can grab the arm of the suspect, swing it up a little bit with their hands slightly behind them, and you can come in and almost scissor your knees around that person's arm. The one knee would be on the back of their scapula, and the other knee would be on the lower rib cage. So if you can get that visual with the leg, with the arm in between those knees, that is an appropriate tactic towards cuffing. And you grab them and you control them, but that's still far enough from the neck. And if somebody would have died inadvertently, say a police officer went into cuff and end up placing their knee on a person's neck and harmed, or even, let me go say an extreme, would have killed somebody by breaking their neck trying to do that cuffing technique, it may have been unfortunate, and I'm not at all minimizing the impact, but then that's where experts can say, in that technique, it was not his intent to come in to put the knee on the neck. It was a result of the arrest, and the officer should not be as liable because his intent was not to come in and put the knee on the neck. He was trying to cuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's almost like the same thing with a police officer trying to shoot a suspect and ends up wounding somebody accidentally while this person's running. He did not intend to shoot that individual, and it's unfortunate, but situations like that happen. So, but in George Floyd's scenario, nowhere is it permitted. So I'm saying that officers are trained to be aware of that. They are trained to not to be careful of that, and he stood there 9 minutes, hand in his pocket, face smirking, why this man struggled to breathe. That's why I'm troubled with it. You can't articulate. He was trying to totally control Mr. Floyd and use, I don't know what hit, what, by what, he was already handcuffed. Even if Mr. Floyd was handcuffed, even if they wanted to put wire ties on his ankles, I mean, he's laying on the ground and you didn't have to put your body weight on. I don't understand what he's thinking. And I don't understand the thinking of the three other officers who at some point was helping to control him, but then some others is walking around. They should have at least, when that man was sitting there saying he could
breathe,
even if Mr. Chauvin was so involved and couldn't think, they should have said, hey, yo, look, the man says he can't breathe, get off of him. And they failed as well. And that's part of training, too. Don't allow those situations to happen.
Yeah, if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Sheldon Williams, former police officer, obviously still very much part of the force in his heart and in his focus of life. But Sheldon, you're also a pastor, and we only have an hour today, and we could talk for a couple of hours. But you said something that, you know, our police force can't be held to a higher standard than our society is willing to be held to. And now, put your pastor hat on, you know, we have stripped our culture so much of morality, of any absolute of truth and what's right and what's wrong. You know, we're seeing, I have a friend who got a letter from the unemployment. There are so many scams out there that we're no longer depositing unemployment checks to any debit cards or anything. We're having to send checks. I have another friend whose address was changed without their knowledge. Their check was sent to a empty house in Munhall, and so the check was obviously stolen, which is no comparison to what we're talking about here. But my point is, we have a sick culture, and we're having to face just not the unpleasantness of a few incidences, but of a moral lack that and I'm struggling for words. But as a pastor, as a fellow pastor, What can we do? What do we do to change the environment, to change the atmosphere, so to speak, that we can affect some real change and the thing is, if we do that and prevent these things from happening, we'll never know what we prevented. You know, it didn't happen, and nobody knows it didn't happen because of something we did. What can we speak as spiritual people to the problem that we are facing?
Sure. So I want to say first, and then I'm gonna pull forward and answer your question, that you said higher standard, and you know, because you and I have talked, that I don't believe in the higher standard aspect for it for law enforcement. I have said it publicly. I have pressed right against, we don't hold our officers to a higher standard. I know what the term means, the phrase means, and it can't exist. We can't expect out of our police officers, we're not willing to accept out of every person in society. It should be the standard. When we have the standard and we're all living according to that standard, then we don't, that term higher standard, yeah, there might be higher accountability. There might be some, you know, we have higher responsibility. And for police officers, they do have a very high responsibility. I don't know. It's a common phrase that I say. I use it in every one of my police trainings. I adopted it and I present it in every one of my police trainings when I'm teaching police officers. There is no other job in America, in the United States, that permits a police officer the level of authority that they have. None. There's none. To include the President of the United States. He has a lot of power in that position, but for a police officer as a person, there's no other job based off of your perception, milliseconds of decision-making, that based off of what you see at that moment, you're able to take somebody's liberty or their life. There's no other job that permits you to do that. That if what you witness and begin to formulate in your mind, whether it's a threat or you think it's a crime, you could go in, the citizens allow, and they empower police officers with that large amount of authority. That authority comes from the citizens. You can take somebody's liberty or their life. Doesn't mean that it'll always be justified, but in that moment, that police officer has a lot of power in their hand. So when we're talking about the standard, that not higher standard, we expect you to have this ethical way of operating, a moral obligation. And so if that person, although they're supposed to be on 24/7 and they're, you know, they're subject to the policies and stuff, because as police officers, they always say they're 24/7, not just in responsibilities. It's just that when they take off their uniform, they still represent the department. But the point that I'm raising is that if the standard across the board in society is that we uphold a certain standard of treatment and interaction with people and care for people, then we will see that happening in our, now we're talking about policing, we'll see that happening in our police department. And so that moral ethical behavior is because it's rooted and founded in godly principle. And our godly principle, Christian principles that we apply, allow for those very strong ethical and moral principles. And so even when a person doesn't proclaim to be a follower of Jesus, when society embraces and aligns itself with those godly principles, you reach the same result. We saw it where the person said that they were a God-fearing, church-going individual. Schools had a very strong moral ethical code that mirrored those biblical principles. A lot of industry had some of those moral ethical principles. So if a person didn't get them in church, they were being mirrored in other places. And what we're seeing now is a degradation of some of those ethical and moral principles that align very closely to godly principles, and that's why it feels like there's this contrast. So it's not even, you know, yeah, it's our constant pursuit to try to get people to be followers of Jesus. But being a follower of Jesus, step one is that proclamation that allows them to walk out of death into life by accepting Jesus as the Savior. But there's the journey along the pathway that says that they're not going to lean into their sinful behaviors. They're going to try to walk in the new nature. And that's only trying to live a life that would be pleasing to God and applying those principles. And that's where that whole discipleship and continuing in relationship benefits that. But we are seeing where more people are pulling away from those relationships. Who's at fault here? It seems we get there's no. I refuse to think that the enemy is winning. I don't believe he's winning. You know, we think people. We don't. He's not winning against us. It's just that we have to. And some of the ways that we were traditionally pursuing how to get people in relationships, now we have to adapt how the church meets the needs of people to put them in healthy Christian relationships so that we can be at the point of accountability and allow them to speak into the lives so that we can continue to pursue those moral and ethical principles that will be the benefit, that will be the fruit of them walking closer with Jesus. So, when I decided to leave the police force, we talked. Before I came on board, you were calling. When you were one of the administrators, you were an administrative pastor before I was. And we had talked several times about the possibility, and there was several times I was like, nope, not interested, until I finally decided to come on board. But my decision to come on board and leave walking day, and I love my job. I absolutely love being a police officer. I could go back to being it today. You stood in shock when you asked me that question one time, and I said, I can do it today. I still can do it. To this day, I can do it. I love it. But I felt like God would allow me different opportunities, stepping out of the department and becoming a pastor, different opportunities to address some of these issues. I was able to do it within the department, but I was limited. I mean, I couldn't be a professing believer out on certain platforms because, the whole separation of church and state and all that stuff, that just prevented. But this gave me more freedom to be on a community side, to really where I was restrained sometimes to be vocal. I might not be able, like this interview you're doing. If I was still in the department, I would have had to probably filter this through my department for approval to make sure, I don't have those restrictions. I could speak freely, and I will continue to do so.
Yeah. We can't get Christian behavior from non-Christians, and it's a deep issue in our culture that, again, we want a standard of a certain behavior, but we've cut people loose from really hearing those standards or being held accountable by those standards. We've got a few minutes, and I do want to leave just a few minutes at the end to talk about something more positive. Your avocation, this other project you have going on that has fed us so well. But before we get to that, can you give us 8 or 9 minutes? And again, this is so abbreviated and so insufficient. Well, what are some suggestions for our listeners? Where do we as a culture, we as interested party, as interesting white people, as interesting black folk, give us some ways forward.
Sure. Faye and I did another interview. You mentioned it with our new lead and his wife, Tara, and Alan, and there's I'm getting texts and phone calls and emails, and a lot of people are reaching out, kind of that don't look like me. Some of them are just expressing that they feel the impact of this as well. Some are asking questions, and I think that's all good stuff. I think if for anybody out there who's listening and have their white friends, Caucasian, or just non-African-American, non-black friends reaching out, asking the questions, don't turn a deaf ear to them. Don't feel like it's patronizing. Let's try to foster those opportunities for connection and talking it through. At least there's an ignition point. But I think as we move forward, the first thing is to things that people can do. If it's just about building an understanding in relationships, it's identify. You have to identify, do you have any biases yourself? And it would be unreasonable. It would be unreasonable to think that none of us have bias. You have not arrived. Until you get out of this to a new one, you're going to have some of these things that you're going to wrestle with. So we need to allow God. That may not be racial. It may not be ethnic biases. It may, but we all hold something. So ask the Lord to show those blind spots You have to seek to say, what am I not seeing? And don't presume that you already know, and that's why it's a blind spot. You don't know it. So you have to get somebody else. And so that could come through other individuals saying, this is what they see, and or the Lord may provoke you and show you yourself, you know, so press into those. But I like to say that on your relationships, what is the depth of the diversity of your relationships? You know, mm-hmm. you and I were colleagues, and we spent mm-hmm. personal time together, love going to games, basketball, football, baseball, hockey. You know, we spend time mm-hmm. together, and during those times, it's not just spectating the game itself. We're spending time and expressing. I share frustrations. You share frustrations. We walk through mm-hmm. life together. And as that example, all I'm saying is when you have individuals, it also gives me say, you know what, Dr. John, that right there, when you said that, this is how I perceive that. And I don't mm-hmm. know, you know, mm-hmm. you could say. So through relationships, you're able to have those very deep discussions that can open up eyes and be able to provide some insight. And I tell people that, for individuals, and it's both sides, you know, when I say this, it can go either way. If your son or daughter came home with somebody that they want to date and they look different than you, what would be your immediate reaction? That's a good, mm-hmm. that would be a good starting point for somebody mm-hmm. to think of, how would mm-hmm. I feel about that? You know, just if they probably said, I'm interested in so-and-so, and they are of a different ethnicity, how would you feel about mm-hmm. that? And that's a good one. Process that question. If a person is not able, come and sit comfortably at your dinner table at any time. If you don't have opportunity for people that don't look like you that can come comfortably and just sit comfortably at your dinner table. I'm not saying eat only at your dinner table. Mm-hmm. I can invite a bunch of people into my house that don't look like me just to serve a meal and put a check in the box. But could they mm-hmm. sit there comfortably around my dinner mm-hmm. table, exchanging conversation, feel like they're at home? That's a different part of that question. If you don't feel like you're able to have that scenario, then that's something to pursue as well, because that means you don't have depth of relationship. You don't feel like mm-hmm. you do. And it's okay. If you don't have it, pursue it, because you can always increase those connection points and build upon that.
Yeah. Oh, I like that depth of relationship. That's a great that's a great phrase. You know, I've said, and I think people misunderstand me when I've posted it, that, you know, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. All I'm trying to say is if I'm going to point the finger at somebody, I have to be willing to look at myself. And when I've labeled something as racist, I have to look in my own heart first, for a nanosecond mm-hmm. even, and say, is there anything there? Because mm-hmm. I am not above it. I am not below it. And so I think it helps in the presentation of it that I'm much softer, I'm much gentler, I'm much less judgmental, because, you know, while we can say, well, he who is without sin cast the first stone, you know, none of us can do that. But we realize, yes, we all fall short, but we still have to make judgments. We still have to make statements. We sometimes still have to confront people who are acting poorly, but it starts with us. And and then my whole adult philosophy has been to build relationships with people who don't look like me, not just on this continent, but other continents. And I guess that was, you know, I shed a few tears on Facebook Live this morning, because when you build relationships like that, my friends are hurting and I can't help mm-hmm. them, and I want to, mm-hmm. but sometimes mm-hmm. all I can do, it's like when, as a pastor, when somebody has lost a loved one, there's nothing I can say. I just have to be there. I just have to be willing to feel bad when they feel bad, and not try to talk them out of how they feel to make me feel good. And I think you addressed some of that in the interview on Saturday. I don't want to try to one up somebody with my pain or, you know, my insight or my perspective. And again, we're almost out of time, and I just want to give a few minutes, and forgive me, listeners, we're going to make a sharp right turn here, but how's the restaurant gone? Tell us a little bit about your new venture as a restaurateur.
Well, that's also, I think, we're talking about depth of relationships and community. you know, we planted a church. ACAC planted a church satellite, but wanted to plant a satellite church over in the Homestead area, and I was selected for ANI to lead that effort, and pleased to be able to be leading that church plant, which is doing well. Love it. It's Fellowship 412, and it is on 435 East 10th Street, Homestead, down from the library. Whenever this COVID and we open back up, I invite any of the listeners to come check us out in that area if you don't have a church home. But part of that, too, you know, we live in this area. We live in an area called New Homestead. We were worshiping over there. Faye and I shop down in the waterfront. I work out down there. You know, we spend time. We walk the trails. And I told her personally, I said, if we're going to be invested in community, we need to invest our dollars. And let's invest our money into this community. And so her and I decided to pursue a business opportunity. And they're a local restaurant, Hook Fish and Chicken. They're all family-owned. And none of them, there's no outsiders that own a Hook Fish and Chicken except Faye and I now. And they're ethnic Muslim. And I emphasize that, not like some champion. Oh, you know, I emphasize how relationships work. We don't believe the same. We have great conversations. Those are my friends. They're my close friends. And, you know, we go and have good conversations on spirituality and faith. But we don't debate and we don't fight over it. We have opportunities for sharing. But we decided, based off of our friendship, that we were the first opportunity to have a license of their restaurant brand. And they gifted us, I'll say, they gifted us this opportunity. And so we were able, by our own money, I praise God for that we had the ability to fully establish that. We had one small loan we had to take at the end, and I mean small because we had a hiccup in the build process and building process that surprised us, that we had to take a small loan to finish the project. But outside of that, and that loan now being taken care of, it was 100% owned by us. We have no debt in the business itself. And it's going well. We hired right from the community. Our first hires were from the community. My family works there as well. You've been there, so you've seen them. Mm-hmm. But we just wanted to make it a strong statement to say we're invested in this community. It's been well received.
Wow.
The community has appreciated it. Our sales are steady. No, we're not rolling over in cash. People think when you own stuff like that, like the money's rolling in, it's a business, you know. But we're profitable. Small measures of profit, but we've only been open since April of last year. But more so, where it's important is I literally have more conversations in my restaurant with meeting people than I did, than I would have ever been able to do trying to sit in the office in the church, inviting people,
church,
trying
right.
to go out on stand on the street. And, you know, I'm not a door-to-door knocking on doors. I mean, some people like that stuff. I don't try to find creative ways for community. But I go down to my store. Faye goes down to my store. People are eating their meal. I come through, you know, I introduce myself or whatever, and I've had good conversation and connection. In fact, I've had people visit our church after having conversations with them from right there at Hope Fish and Chicken Homestead.
Yeah,
so all I'm saying is it's a part about being community, showing community within to launch it, but I wanted it to be a beacon of blessing so that we can build and be able to connect in community down there. So it's doing well.
Give our listeners the address real quick.
Sure. Hook Fish and Chicken Homestead, 605-607 Amity Street, right across from the Aldi. As you head into the waterfront, we are there, the red, white, and blue building. Stop on in. I'm sure you get some good food, some good conversation as you wait for that good food.
Amen. Amen. Sheldon, thank you for your time. I'll have you back. We can track your progress because obviously God is stirring something in you. We'll all be interested in where it ends up. Thank you for who you are, what you do, our love to your family, and I know we'll stay in touch.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye. All right, Pastor Sheldon Williams, former police officer, now pastor, very insightful things to say. Again, Hook Fish and Chicken, 605, 607, and Amity over on in Homestead across from Aldi's on the entrance to the waterworks in Homestead and waterfront. And so anyway, tomorrow we have Pastor Tom Laird on talking about counseling in this season and time. And until then, this is John Stanko signing off for another day. Go be about the work of your purpose. So long for now.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.